Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And on our program today, we're bringing you some nice French sweets and then something a little bit more.
Yeah,
sweet, it doesn't quite fit
sweets,
the program.
Sweets and more. Well, we can't have all dessert. Otherwise, all of you listeners would desert us because we're impacting your dietary capabilities.
But you know, first up, we've interviewed Hilary Davis before, and she's always a great interview, and she sure knows her. Having lived in France for so long, she sure knows about things French. And she turned her attention for this latest book of hers to desserts, French desserts. They're iconic throughout the world.
Are these the way Le Petit Sweets? Oh, they're French desserts.
These are French desserts.
These are French, regular French
desserts.
Okay.
Petite Sweets.
All right. Well, I wasn't sure. I didn't have the sheets in front of me like you do. So anyway, here's Hilary Davis.
Hilary Davis, what is the number of cookbook this is? Your new book is called French Desserts, but we've interviewed you before for one of your cookbooks. So what number is this?
This is number 4.
Okay.
And I'm actually working on another one right now, but it won't be French.
Oh, really?
I'm going to give that a little rest and then maybe do a French wine and French food one in the future.
Yeah, well, you know,
I love cookbook writing.
Do you really? It's so tedious. I mean,
and it's fun because, there's a social aspect to it. I write the recipes and then I test them like 5 times in my own kitchen. Then the fun part is I send it out to all these people that I know from social media or just friends. And they test them for me. And we go back and forth and back and forth. So it becomes a communal effort. And I think that's where the joy comes in. It's a lot of fun. It ensures that the recipes are always tested, by other people a lot.
That's great.
But I also have fun interacting with them. And sometimes they say, instead of Grand Marnier, why don't you put in, Chambord. It'll give it a beautiful pink color. And so we just have fun together. And that's why I love writing cookbooks. I've made so many new friends. I just love the whole process. Yeah.
But that's why I like doing the podcast with interviews, because I get to interact with so many people. And I always learn something.
Exactly.
And I learned a lot from this book. Let's sort of narrow down. This is not the whole world of French desserts. You're focusing on French regional specialties in desserts, right?
Well, yes. And like all my cookbooks, I try and make a very strong point. I'm trying to get across that French cooking is home cooking.
Yes, exactly.
And we have in our minds that French cooking is where we go to restaurants and they're just precious and beautiful dishes and it's a delight. But in truth, the majority of meals made in France are made at home. And you go, they go out to a restaurant, a really fancy restaurant, if they want a treat. They go walk down the street. Sometimes once a day, more than once a day, for a fancy dessert, little desserts, wonderful things that would take hours to make at home. But when they cook at home, which is the majority of the time, their desserts are really easy. It would be something my grandmother would have thrown together. They just happen to taste so good. The combinations and the sheer simplicity and beauty of when you pull out of the oven this bread that is made in the Ardennes, which is a region of France, and it's called sweet bread. And it's actually all it has in it is flour, yeast, sugar, eggs, and I think it's milk I have in there. I keep changing, but I think it's milk. So simple. And the smell when it comes out of the oven brings tears to your eyes. It smells so good. And you put it on a big old wooden platter with homemade jams and some nice sweet butter and eat it while it's warm with your tea. I mean, these kind of desserts, so many of them, in the book and in daily French life are made with just a few ingredients.
Yeah, but you specify in your book, you say, if, since it is just a few ingredients, these ingredients have to be top-notch, the very best.
Yeah, that's the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, here you can get away with margarine and some, you know, chocolate chips from the supermarket to make things that people don't really, you know, they're just quick desserts. But there, they, at home, they really do, you know, they actively search out the best peach to put into a custard and use the best cream. And I think that's why when we travel there or visit friends, we swoon when we have these relatively simple desserts, because the well-known trick is they use the best ingredients. And,
well, but you play a little bit, too. You play around with some recipes, too, because you like to throw in fresh herbs and different kinds of spices. And those are fun. Those recipes are fun. What are some of those?
Well, the one that I think came out the best, and I'm getting the best response in that area, is it's a fresh fruit salad that has dried fruit in it as well, and then it has a fresh basil broth.
Oh yes.
And it sounds odd, and it has herbs de Provence. I make a broth in the beginning that you marinate all of the fruit in this herbs de Provence tea, which permeates the herbs in herbs de Provence permeate some of the fruits and give it this wonderful deep flavor. And then when you serve it with fresh basil infused broth. You know, it's all lukewarm or chilled, and it is so good. So yes, I played with a recipe that I tasted in France in the Southwest, and I was blown away by the just lovely flavors that came through together. So yeah, I do play around a little bit. I do like using fresh herbs in desserts.
And vegetables. You use vegetables too?
Yep. Sometimes I use tomatoes because that's a fruit.
Yeah.
You know, the in various parts of the world, avocado are used a lot in dessert. So I freely throw that in if I think it's going to be fun and above all taste good. Those are little things you might find at a better restaurant in France.
You showed me one that was like a savory cheesecake.
Yeah, that was.
Which one was that?
Oh, I'm looking for that. It's served a cheese and cheesecake. Do you know which one I'm talking about, Hillary?
It
looked so good. I'm sort of leaving through the book.
It had a savory flavoring of some kind.
I do throw in savory. I mean, some of the crust in my tarts.
Yes.
I like to flavor tart crust. I love playing with that.
Yes.
Sometimes I'll grind, you know, fennel seeds and put a lot of that in the crust.
Yeah, it was a fennel crust with plums. Do you know which one that is?
With plums, yes. That's like a plum crumble, but in a way it looks like that, and it has a beautiful savory fennel crust, which plays off the sweetness of the filling. So I do like texture and color and surprise in a dessert. I really like a surprise. So I have fun with them. And I hope when you make them at home or for your guests, I hope it delights them to find a little surprise in what they're tasting.
Yeah, but I thank you for making it okay to use frozen dough.
Why not?
I think anybody who tackles that, making that dough on their own at home must be nuts.
Oh, yeah. No, and the French, I mean, French women are very clever cooks, and so many of them work, and they run home, and then they'll roll out the puff pastry. And, you know, there's a dessert called pissifié, and they're in a lot of pastry shops, and it looks like they're absolutely impossible to make. and you'd think you'd have to buy the thing, which you could, but it's one of the easiest desserts in my cookbook to make. It is just amazing because you just roll out puff pastry dough, throw your ingredients in the center, put a top on it, and bake it.
I don't know about this. This looks a little tough to me. Len's grandmother's rice pudding cake bathed in caramel.
Is that tough? And very easy, and it comes out
really
so pretty. It's one I make for guests. Because, you know, you turn a creme caramel over and you put it on a beautiful plate, how beautiful it looks, a big one. Well, this is the same thing, but it's her grandmother made rice pudding, and you just stir it in the pot on the stove. And then you throw it into a souffle dish and chill it, and you turn it over on a platter, and it looks beautiful. And it has its own built-in magical secret dark caramel sauce that when you turn it over, it just pours by itself all over this luscious, creamy rice, cold rice pudding.
Well, you know, I liked your...
Yeah, it looks hard, but...
Yeah, I liked your uses that described for this wine and grape harvest loaf cake, because you say how well it goes with the cheese platter.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's mostly, you know, in France, they love, I think Sophie Pic, who is a famous French chef.
Sophie,
She's wonderful, Sophie. And she had a cookbook that got all the French going crazy for making loaf, what we call loaf cakes, made in a bread pan.
Uh-huh.
And they're quick cakes, or the French call them also weekend cakes. And you just slice them up and take them with you as a hostess gift or to a picnic. And they take about 2 minutes to stir up. So that's one of them, the harvest grape cake. And it has a lot of, it's scented with cardamom. And so
I love cardamom
in it.
I love cardamom.
Yeah, and then it just, anything, in pancakes.
Right. Now, tell us about your cover cookie, this big cookie I love that story.
That is my favorite cookie. I fell in love when I first had it. And everyone I give it to hoards it, grabs a piece, takes it home, shares it. It's a giant cookie. We make giant cookies here. There's recipes for them. But this one is thick. It comes out about 1.5 inches to 2 inches high. And it's about 12-inch diameter circle. It takes about 3 minutes to throw together. And then you shape it into this big circle and you bake it, and that's it. But I found it in France in this one little village. And there was a wedding going on, and I was just snapping pictures for my Instagram account because it was so pretty. Well, they dragged me in with the guest to the little, very modest reception in the church parish hall. And they had this giant cookie there, and the bride and the groom and all their best friends and then the rest of us afterwards just went over to this cookie and broke off a piece and shared it. And the sharing part was such a beautiful ceremony in my mind. It was so symbolic and lovely. So since then, almost every time I have a dinner party, I bake one. And I put, for dessert, even if I'm serving other desserts, I put my huge break and share cookie in the middle of the table for us to break cookie. Instead of breaking bread, we're breaking cookie and sharing with each other. So I love that one.
Yeah, I do too. And I found the one that Peter was talking about. It's your Swiss chard and goat cheese cheesecake tart.
Oh, that is so good.
I want that.
It's a total accident.
Oh, Hillary, tell us about it.
I think you'd like that, Anne.
Tell me about it.
I think you'd like it.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, I'm crazy for Swiss chard, and it's using ingredients that my village uses a lot, goat's cheese. They're crazy for Swiss chard in along the Riviera and near Niçoise cooking. So I just got made up one day because I wanted cheesecake. So I bought local goat's cheese, and I looked at my counter, and I had this beautiful rainbow Swiss chard. So I just put together this recipe, threw in some, you know, different things, raisins and pine nuts, and just a butter cookie crust to make it, you know, firm to hold the cheesecake. It's really good. It was just a crazy day. I made it up, and it's delicious.
Well, that's I'm going to try that one because it looks like I could eat it right this minute, so I better make it myself since you're not here. Can you, Hillary, can you give like an overview, a generalization of like what trends or what pastries or what desserts are popular in which regions of France?
Yeah, that's easy. So in the Normandy, Brittany area where they have these fabulous bovines, you know, these cows grazing.
Oh, yeah, and the butter.
Everywhere, they're beautiful. So they have a lot of butter and cream in that area. So most of your desserts are going to be butter-centric or cream-centric. And most people know those desserts the best as being French. But, you know, there's some surprises in that region that are favorite desserts there that we don't know about. I had never heard of Farce Buen, and I don't always say it correctly, but they're broken crepes. They make them, and especially Brittany, you know, they love crepes.
Uh-huh.
And at home, they make this thing really quickly for their kids. They throw crepe batter in a frying pan, any kind of frying pan with lots of butter. They start cooking the crepe as you would normally, leaving it alone. And as it starts to form, they start breaking it up, like with a fork and a knife, as if they're slicing, you know, a steak. They keep doing that. They add more butter and sugar. So now all those little pieces of crepe are getting caramelized and golden and buttery. And they serve it all in a big family communal bowl with a big spoon, and the kids all get a big spoonful, and I serve it with a little bit of vanilla ice cream or whipped cream to melt over it. So that's the one we don't know. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen it in a cookbook.
I never even heard of it.
And that's so popular.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then Far Breton prune, you know, the prune custard cake they make there is everywhere, and I have a recipe for that that's really delicious. And then, you know, in the south where I lived, it's all about healthy and Mediterranean cooking, so we eat more fruit. Yeah, we eat more fruit. You won't see butter and cream in our recipes. It would be rare. You know, they do, some restaurants do creme caramel, but they do it with milk. It's relatively fat-free. So in the south, it's much healthier. They're going to use their fresh oranges, fresh, you know, lemons to make lemon tarts and fruit salads and the beautiful cavaillon melons they'll make into a cold melon soup. So everything is quite fresh oriented and fruit oriented. And then around Dijon, Dijon is to the east. And they make these wonderful little baby things called nonettes.
Oh, yeah, the little nuns.
The little nuns.
Yeah.
And I make them, they have pans there, but I make them in little mini muffin tins. But they're delicious. And when you get them in France from a nice bakery or at someone's home, they'll have a little, like, teaspoon of bitter orange marmalade in the center that just delights children to find that little treat in the center of their little baby cake. So that's in the book. That's a very easy, fun recipe.
Well, you can tell that you are passionate about this kind of baking. I mean, and it shows in your writing.
I love it.
it does, and it's beautifully photographed. I think it's just a great book, Hillary.
Oh, thank you, Anne.
Okay, it's Hillary Davis, and it's French Desserts. And I want this cookie on the cover.
If I come see you, I'll make you one. I'll bring one and share it with you.
And by the magic of social media, we know you have a guest coming who's carrying a blueberry pie.
It's a very, very well loved guest.
So it's probably time for you to break off and have a piece of pie.
That's right. Well, Gail Green is a friend of many people and well loved.
Oh, she's great.
That's who's going to come. Yeah.
Well, continue on. You're already working on your next book. You have.
I am.
Yeah, you have a great work ethic, I must say, and I admire it enormously because you think it's fun writing cookbooks. I thought I wrote one, and it was the most tedious thing I ever did in my life.
Oh, my gosh.
It's great talking to you again, Hillary.
Pleasure. I love talking to you guys.
Okay. Ciao, ciao, Hillary.
And we love talking to you, Hillary, and we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and a very sensible approach to desserts, to French desserts, the French themselves exercise, is making a whole variety of just perfect little gems, two bites.
Making them smaller.
Yeah, two-bite desserts.
Hence Le Petit Sweet.
Yes.
Amazing. Amazing. What a wonderfully descriptive title and a wonderfully descriptive book.
This is one sweet book, and I mean that in many different ways. We're going to be talking to the authors, Catherine Gordon and Anne E. McBride, who is not Irish, and it's called Le Petit Sweet. And it's perfectly, what's the format here? It's how many inches by how many inches? It's a perfect little square. And what you're talking about in this book is they're all French, and almost all of them are traditional classical French sweets, but you infuse them with a whole variety of really non-traditional French flavors, and they're all in exactly the proportion that I would like them, two bites. Let's start with... How about your background, Catherine? Aren't you called something besides Catherine?
No, just Catherine.
Okay.
Unless you're in my class, in which case the students call you chef, but, you know.
Oh, no.
That's about the main things I answer to, I would say.
Okay, well, you're both veteran pastry chefs here. And, Catherine, what's your background?
Well, I have like a different background. I started off on Wall Street in management consulting. So I got an MBA in finance, actually from NYU where Anne went later, but for her graduate work. I don't know. At one point, I became a pastry chef and went to pastry school. Now, that was a long time ago. I've been doing this for a long time, and I've been teaching about 13 years. So the same school in New York.
You know, this
but
must
I go
be
to France
a pattern.
Every year.
This must be a pattern. Do you know Joanne Chang?
No.
Oh, she's a pastry chef, and she's in Boston, and she has restaurants or cafes, too. But she started out also on Wall Street.
Right. Okay. So, yeah.
And then you have...
Good way to start.
What's the other one what's her name? Sandra Bullock's sister started out in the movie business and dumped it all and started baking. So there must be a huge appeal to this baking, right?
I've even, like, had a couple of students who are dentists, but I always think that's, like, a little cheating because they can create their own dental clients by baking.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret is I go to a gym and I have a personal trainer, and my personal trainer also has a sweets truck catering service and two bakeries.
Oh, God.
No conflict there. So you now, Catherine, are at the Institute of Culinary Education, not to be confused with the, what's the other one, the culinary?
Oh, the competitive schools.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we won't dignify them with a mention.
Well, Anne has been associated with one of the competitive schools.
So. I see. All right. Anne McBride, you are the one that has a Swiss-French accent, right?
Exactly. My mom is Swiss and my dad is French, and I grew up in Switzerland.
Okay, and you are not only a book co-author of many books, six I think it says here, but you direct the Experimental Cuisine Collective at NYU. Now, what is that?
The Experimental Cuisine Collective is a collaboration between the Food Studies Department, where I teach and I'm finishing my PhD, and the Chemistry Department at NYU. And we organize monthly monthly, now it's more a few a year, where we bring together chef scientists, culinary enthusiasts to talk about the places where science and food intersect.
Well, now this book...
I'm sorry?
Now, this book is sort of the perfect example of that because here you start with classic French types of desserts, but you apply a modernist approach to most of them, don't you?
I don't know, Catherine. I'll let you answer that on the techniques. I mean, they're still, from my perspective, they're still fairly classic.
Yeah, you're right. It's not the techniques. It's the flavor combinations, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, there's that whole world of molecular gastronomy, which Anne spends a lot of time at the collective with people who know that. And, like, you know, I like learning about that, but I think I'm still kind of a traditionalist in terms of technique. But I, you know, I'm an American, but I've lived in London and Australia, and I take people to France every year to go work with chefs, so I think my mind is kind of like, I see things almost like with a blinders on, but it's kind of like twisting things, you know, like from the classics and trying to do things that are new from flavor perspectives, and that's how we wind up in both books with some things that are not French, and they're not American, you know, but it's definitely a blending, you know, or a modernizing of maybe the flavors.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm looking here at a coffee cardamom. That's a great combination.
Well, I mean, you know what's funny is I live in an area in Brooklyn where they have a lot of Arabic grocery stores, and if you just go really quickly into one of them and you grab a packet of coffee, you can actually buy one which is pre-blended with cardamom.
Oh, sure.
I'm not expecting that. It's a little different, but it's not unpleasant. It's good, but, like, it's not necessarily what people are expecting if they're just expecting their plain morning coffee.
Yeah, I mean, here you have black pepper and sour cream madeleine. That's wonderful.
When we were doing the head notes, right, and, like, you know, talking about, like, potatoes with sour cream and black pepper, but, like, to me, like, the flavor thing, you know, you sort of start thinking, like, what would be good with this, and you try it out, and then you kind of figure out how much of the spice or whatever that you need to create a nice balance.
Now, I should emphasize it because the whole theme of this book is not just the flavors, but that you could make all of these in like two bite sizes so that your guests can sample a variety, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody wants to eat just one giant big helping of a dessert, right?
See,
so, like, they don't want to be seen doing that, you know. They may want it, but they're not going to, like, necessarily take that off the buffet, you know, right in front of their friends.
Tell me why, I mean, Macaron is like a traditional, long-standing dessert. Americans grabbed a hold of it and made it a macaroon, which had nothing to do with the original macaron. And now they're all madly in love with the French version of a macaron.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, to me, it's like when we were doing the first book, Anne did some great, like, original research because she can speak French and she's in academia. So she, you know, traced it back. A lot of people seem to think it's Italian, right, Anne? But we believe it's French. But, you know, La Durée is very associated in terms of French pastry shops with macaron. But to me, the first time I ever saw them is in the 1980s in the window of La Durée in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
And then the first time I ever made them was when I was working at the Rainbow Room, but with a French-trained pastry chef.
Wow.
And so they were here, but they were not so popularized until Pierre Hermé became the corporate pastry chef of La Durée, like in the 80s and early 90s. And so, like, he's very associated with macaron, but he was actually at La Durée.
He's the one who really started coming up with all of the very creative flavor combinations that we've come to associate with them.
Uh-huh.
So, it used to be only vanilla, pistachio, and mocha were pretty much the flavors you would find. And then he started really changing that and making it much more interesting, and it revived a whole interest in the sector in a way. The macaroons that exist in the U.S. really come from the Germanic tradition of baking that has also been more prevalent with immigration here. The type of, a little bit simpler and almost more rustic, whereas the macarons for a long time were really just something, even in France, that you would buy in a pastry shop, but you would never try to make yourself.
I just covered this 2016 Fancy Food Show, and in confections, for the second year in a row, and maybe even more so, caramels were made the biggest splash. I don't understand. I've never understood people's, I love the flavor of caramel, but these are actually caramels. You know, the kind that you bite into and it sticks in your teeth?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
My favorite ones of them were always at the Maison de Chocolat.
Oh, yeah.
When they opened up on the Upper East Side in New York years ago, and they brought in everything from France, they brought in a range of, like, maybe four different flavors of caramels, and, like, that indulgence was always, like, so expensive. But, like, that's why it's great that you can make your own.
Uh-huh.
But they're just not, like, what you can get. You know, like at a grocery store in terms of the caramels, like at Halloween time for apples or something.
Uh-huh.
It's so much better and smoother and flavorful to be able to...
You have a salted goat caramel crème as well. And you make your own, that's another hot thing, is people making their own marshmallows.
I know when I first started to make marshmallows, a lot of people made them with egg whites.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the egg whites are getting cooked, so there's really nothing wrong with it. But, you know, if you were trying to, like, kind of make them for a friend and have them as a present or something, it's not like in a restaurant where you're just making them every day and kind of going through them. So to make a non-egg white-based marshmallow, it may not be quite as fluffy, but they're fluffy enough. And to me, it's just a good way to kind of stage them and not have to worry about egg-related issues.
Yeah. Well, you do a lot with meringues in this book and talk about temperamental. You said, Catherine, that you lived in Australia?
Yeah.
What part of Australia?
Pavlovas. Yeah. In Sale in Victoria.
Where?
I think it's in the middle of nowhere. It was near the oil field when my dad was an engineer.
Oh, okay. We lived in Geelong. You know Geelong?
No,
south of Melbourne. But, but, you know, I, of course, learned to make, pavlova. And I had the recipe that always worked over there. But when I came to this, back to the States, that recipe never worked. And when my Australian friend visited, she was fiddling around, and it really had a lot to do with humidity.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, I like pavlova, right? I mean, if you ever meet somebody from New Zealand, of course, they claim it too, but that gets kind of fun. But I remember once when I was working, the chef was French, and I made a pavlova, and, like, to them, it's, like, alien, because, like, all meringue should be baked crisp.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, a pavlova is deliberately slightly chewy with the cream and the fruit and everything.
Right.
It's so funny. He basically spit it out because it was, like, alien to them, you know? It's like, this is a deliberate thing, you know? It's very funny.
I made one in the States that did not turn out, and my luncheon guest said that was the first dessert that they had used a knife and a fork with, and a knife, you know. It was terrible. tell me, you have tips for every, I mean, your instructions are very clear, so I'm assuming you know that from having taught for so long. But you've all these tips about baking that are very sensible. What do you think is the biggest mistake that non-French people make with French desserts? Probably making them at home instead of going to the bakery.
No. I don't know. In general, French desserts? Well, I don't even... I'm just trying to think. Anne, do you have any thoughts on that one?
I think the biggest mistake that people make in the U.S. with French desserts is they underbake them. Because what you find often in French bakeries, things are much more golden than what you'll find here. So people tend to pull things out of the oven a little bit too soon because they're afraid of it browning too much. And so I think for me, that's one of the biggest differences really found here. And then probably also, but I guess that depends on the flavor profiles, but also may have a tendency to oversweet here, even when using or making classic French desserts, just making them a little more sweet than you would find them in France.
Yeah, well, you put a lot of savory touches into your sweets in this book.
Yeah, I think that's just sort of the way I think, because I've been around a lot of pastry competitions, and if you're hanging out with a lot of people trying to judge a lot of desserts, if everything's sweet, it just, you know, becomes like a blur. And you're trying to differentiate your food through flavor that isn't sweet. And so by, like Anne's right, cutting out the sugar can help to do that. And I actually completely concur with her in terms of like baking like tartlet shells or other kinds of things that Americans, like, for example, if they try to make croissant or something, pull them out of the oven too early because they think it's burning. But if you actually are with a French pastry chef, they cook them so long that Americans would think it was burnt. But to them, it's a flavor, and it's beautiful. It's the butter browning. It's technically called the Maillard reaction, and that's, like, what creates flavor. And you get much more complexity in the dishes and the desserts when you cook that way. And you just have to give it a little bit more time in the oven.
Now, you joined the great debate about cannelle.
Uh-huh.
And you, throughout your book, you sometimes encourage people to use silicone molds, but here you come down on the side of you have to invest in the copper molds.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it in both. I mean, it will work in the silicone, but I think there's something to the actual weight of the copper that batter is going to go poof and move, kind of like in the popover family.
Uh-huh.
And if you're trying to control your shape and that's going to bother you, just found general better baking overall evenness was better with the metal classic molds.
They're not cheap.
But the silicone worked, but they're just like kind of like little like corks. You know, like corks popping. It's they have a mind of their own in the silicone.
Uh-huh.
You don't get as crisp a shell. I make them in both because sometimes I just want to, you know, do it fairly quickly and not be bothered with prepping the copper molds, for example. And the result is still very good in terms of the flavor in the silicone, but the difference between the contrast between the crispy shell and the custardy interior is not as strong if you make them that way.
How are the French pastry makers coming down on the subject of 3D printing?
I don't know that the French ones want that much. I don't know. What do you think, Anne? You see it ever in the cuisine collective discussion?
No, I haven't really seen a lot about 3D printing in terms of what I follow, you know, on French media or things like that in relation to food. But even here, I mean, it's not that you go to, you know, a pastry shop in New York or in San Francisco and you'll see a lot of 3D printing here either, or in restaurants for desserts yet. It could potentially, I think if anything, it's going to get more, we'll see more and more of that as the technology becomes cheaper. And there's some really interesting decorating work. The Culinary Institute of America, where organized culinary conferences, has a 3D lab now and 3D printer. And they do a lot of work in baking because the students there are very interested in that. So I think we'll probably see a little bit more of that, but I think in France there's still a huge pride in demonstrating your knowledge of the techniques and not necessarily letting a machine do that for you.
That makes sense. I interviewed somebody from the Institute of Culinary Education. I can't remember. He was on the faculty there. But we started talking about Watson when that cookbook was coming out. But I've never been able to get anybody to come and talk to me or get a copy of the Watson's cookbook. Have you seen it, Catherine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know the two people who work on it here, Michael Esconis and James Bristone. So, you know, I think, you know, that whole process, I think they felt the book kind of part at the end was kind of rushed, but they worked with that so long, and it was very interesting and kind of like a learning curve, and then, you know, I think they really enjoyed the process.
No.
Yeah, let's be honest.
Yeah.
He used to be at Le Bernardin.
Exactly.
And then, I don't know, several years ago he joined the faculty at ICE as a creative director. And so he's been, like when we moved into our new facility, he has a chocolate bean to bar lab and all kinds of interesting classes. And, you know, he's very much a very smart person, theoretician. You can learn a lot, you know, from him.
Oh, you could, so much is going on. Well, at any rate, this is a very useful book, and I think that people should try, and I think you could do a lot of the things in this book because of all the good tips that you give. And they are two bite desserts, which is going to be great for your waistline. And again, it's Les Petits Sweets. I'm with Catherine Gordon and Anne E. McBride. And thank you two for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and we're going to move a little past the French aspect of desserts, and also include some savory items with our next guest. You will get a taste of s'mores, gooey s'mores, as it says, but you're supposed to be able to make these classics simply and quickly, like 30 minutes. And that sounds pretty good to me.
And not only that, when you think you're done with them, you're not entirely done because the instructions follow are in the title of the book, Lick Your Plate.
Yes. Lick Your Plate is kind of an interesting name for a cookbook. It's the kind of thing your mother always told you not to do, right?
This is Julie speaking. Yes, our mother always told us we weren't allowed to lick our plates, but then again, our first cookbook was called Bite Me, so we tend to toe that line.
Now, did your mother also tell you not to put your elbows on the table?
Yeah, there was that, and
probably not to pull my sister's hair or steal the meringue off my brother's lemon meringue pie, but I did that all the same.
That's very good. I think I would do that, yes.
I'm surprised you're still alive. If you were, if you were my sister and you stole my lemon meringue, your days on this earth would be strictly numbered.
Yes, it's all about the meringue. Yes.
It is. Well, anyhow, we have Julie Albert and Lisa Gannett, and they are... One of you is stronger in the cooking, in the kitchen, than the other, and the other one's the journalist, right?
That's correct.
So which is which?
Lisa, do you want to... Okay, I'll speak because I'm the one who... it's Julie, and I am the one who does the writing and the look of the books. I'm also a very skilled eater, and that's thanks to my sister, Lisa.
Uh-huh.
And this is Lisa, and I do the recipe development, and I get a lot of inspiration from my sister, Julie.
Wow. What a wonderful relationship here.
And you were twins born 2 years apart.
We are.
And we got,
Lisa doesn't feel well, I take an aspirin.
Yeah. So we're gonna have either Hoda or Matt Lauer or whoever it is explain this to us from, where is it, Rio de Janeiro? Because that's where everything's happening these days.
Yes, it is. And we would have fed those Olympians very well.
I'll bet you would.
There's
still time to zoom down there.
Tell me this. This is your third book, and the first one is called Bite Me, and I don't understand that. And then the second one is Bite Me Too, which confused me even further. Tell me what those titles mean.
Well, haven't you always wanted to say bite me and not get in trouble?
No.
No? Okay, well then, you're not as cheeky as I am, but...
Why would you want somebody to bite you?
Well, it's just an expression, but it's just the idea of us wanting someone to take a big bite out of our book.
I see. Well, you're Canadian, so maybe it's Canadian sense of humor, huh?
No, I mean, okay, sure. When we're cracking jokes, you know, because it's about Mounties and igloos, usually.
Oh.
And then you have to say A on the end of every sentence.
Yes, A, exactly. We have to end with A.
It's very important.
The subtitle of this is a lip-smacking book for every home cook. So it's directed specifically at home cooks, right?
Yes, that's right. Our mission is to make everyone's life easier and answer that question, what's for dinner?
Uh-huh. Well, that's a question I hate. Tell me this. As I'm looking over all of the
blurbs, they're called, generally.
Blurbs. What are they called?
Blurbs.
Blurbs.
Testimonials, blurb.
Yeah, well, you seem to have an awful lot of actors in your fan club. Or TV celebrities. Why is that?
We have currency, and it's called the White Chocolate Cranberry Cookie. And Lisa's cookies can open so many doors, you have no idea.
Well, now, this is the time when I'm allowed to ask my question, and you'll answer it, which is, how did you persuade people to give you all these witty, witty quotes?
We sent them galleys of the book, and we sent them cookies, and we crossed our fingers. And they seem to take to us saucy sisters.
Uh-huh. You didn't have any introduction to, like, to George Harrison, for example?
To who?
George Harrison.
Oh, we don't have a quote from George Harrison, like a testimonial.
But you have a joke from him. You have a joke from him.
Well, you switch the subject, right?
You have a witty... Well, they're sort of the same.
Well, now they're confused about what you're asking them.
Okay, well, I...
Okay, well, we did have people such as John Bon Jovi and Jason Alexander, who plays George Costanza, and Gail Simmons. They all endorsed Lick Your Plate. Throughout the course of the book, we do have quite a bit of pop culture references, and those are quotes that we've taken but attributed to other people.
Oh, I see. So you made them up.
No, we quoted them. Like, for example, we quoted Rodney Dangerfield in one of our recipes, but we didn't make it up. We just used their quote.
One of his movie quotes.
Attributed his name to it.
I understand what they're saying, Rob, but I don't know why you don't.
There are these little bonbons or jokes.
No, they're just quotes, that's all. I mean, you could...
Did George Harrison say, we're the Spice Boys?
He did say that.
Yes, he did say that.
He did not say that to me.
Okay.
Yeah, now
he said that on the group, and it ended up on this thing called the World Wide Web.
Okay. All right. So you went searching for witty stuff.
Yeah,
correct.
Part of the charm of the book is that the introduction.
I said it was going to be some kind of earth-shattering secret. It's really not.
Oh, I thought you were asking about how we got to John Bon Jovi, Gail Simmons, and Jason Alexander.
That's what I was asking. Well, that was my question.
Well, that was going to be another question.
Yes, our cookies open those doors.
Good.
We can send you some if you'd like.
Yeah, that sounds like a winning concept.
Then you can
quote me in your next book. I have no idea what I'll say. It'd probably be rude.
Again, remind me who does the introductions, the little intros.
That's me.
Julie.
It's Lisa.
Julie.
That's who I thought it was. And Julie, one of the things that strikes me about this book is it's very, very, really exciting graphically. Now, you supervise that too?
Yes, I did.
I mean, do you have art in your background? Well, I mean, they're wonderful. Illustration.
I don't, but I love graphic design. I also believe that there's more to a cookbook, obviously. I mean, Lisa's recipes are foolproof, and they're incredible and easy to recreate, but also giving people some eye candy is something really important to us as well, and letting them see what it would look like. We don't use any trickery in our photography, so it's really, you can expect the same results as we got. And Lisa really taught me the genesis of our cookbook relationship was she taught me how to cook because we have six teenagers between us and I didn't know how to.
Oh yeah, that floored me. I thought, how would you have time to write a cookbook? Not even one, but three.
The lucky part is that we're that person who writes a cookbook split in half. Lisa does the recipe development, I do the writing and look, and together we're that one powerhouse person, so it's a very lucky relationship.
And you starve your children, right?
Lisa doesn't. Julie's kids get Lucky Charms. My kids are lucky. My kids get to test the whole book.
That's pretty exciting, huh?
Now, tell us a little bit about these icons, which are very handy.
So what we decided to, we do have 160 recipes in Lick Your Plate, but we also wanted to give people help people and take the thinking out of things for them. So we wanted to take the thinking out of meal planning. So we have pairings in the book where we say make this chicken with this vegetable, to make a meal out of it. We help people save time, so we give tips and tricks. And over 40 of our recipes take under 30 minutes. We show people how to turn leftovers into lunch. So you've made the meatballs, and the next day you're going to make that Italian meatball.
So you have that's a very clever little icon. It's a recycled thing made out of forks.
Yeah, we were very lucky to work with an illustrator. I don't know if you noticed, but in the 10 chapters throughout the book, they're all introduced with using illustration. And we worked with a Brooklyn-based illustrator who did those for us.
Oh, I think they're fabulous. Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's extremely clever.
Oh, they're wonderful. Well, your titles for your chapters organized in your book are clever, too. No fork required is appetizers. Steamed up is soups. Crunch time is salads. And on. I like... no bones about it. I thought that was very clever.
Oh, thank you.
And that was?
Well, we do like to bring a little bit of
fun to it.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. No, we like to bring a little bit of fun to everything that we do because we know that peeling potatoes can be kind of boring. And if we can bring some laughs into the kitchen or a little bit of light, a little levity into the kitchen, then that's great.
How about, can you pick out some recipes that you think are pretty unique that you've included in the book? These are all made from scratch.
They're all made from scratch.
Okay, how about some really unique ones? You want to pick out some faves?
Well, so when you say unique, you know, the way we cook, we really like to cook, like, for families. So they're interesting, but they're still very doable.
Right.
So all of our recipes, you know, one of my favorites is a miso chicken sandwich with a crunchy slaw. And if you...
chicken enchilada soup topped with crunchy tortillas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all crowd pleasers. And yeah. What Lisa is able to do is take something like buttermilk pancakes and turn them into apple pie buttermilk pancakes. So she takes what you would expect and then does a little twist to make it that much more delicious. One of my favorite salads is a falafel salad with lemon tahini dressing. So it's like baking the falafels instead of frying them and keeps it a little bit healthy, turning it into a salad.
So you have healthy in the back of your mind, too, when you're doing these.
Yeah, well, deep fried. Yeah, really. But we really do enjoy dessert. And if you were to look through the dessert section, you would know we really do enjoy real
dessert is dessert.
I love the apple pie pancakes myself, to tell you the truth.
Mm. Yeah, I'm a pancake fanatic, so that's always my go-to.
I don't do pancakes, actually. My grandchildren get frozen waffles. That's not very good either. Now, which are these famous cookies?
They're in our first book, Bite Me. And they're white, chunky white chocolate cranberry cookies that very much started what Lisa and I do together. She was able to recreate and improve upon a cookie I had tasted. And they're out of this world. And Lisa has continued in that vein through all three of our cookbooks.
I see. Interesting.
And in this cookbook, in Lick Your Plate, you can find a double cranberry and white chocolate scone. And so it's sort of reminiscent of the cookie, but in a scone.
So
the Chewy S'mores pudding cookies are quite delicious.
Where are those now? Tell me about those.
Those are in Lick Your Plate, and it's like the trifecta of what everybody loves about s'mores, graham crackers, chocolate, and marshmallows,
Okay. All
in a cookie. We actually just posted a video where we show people how to make them in 63 seconds. So
really?
Yeah, it's on our website, bitememore.com, and we just posted that this week.
Oh, my.
Now, let's do that website again, bitememore.com.
Yep, bitememore.com, so bitememore.com.
It sounds like a good place to go. It sounds like a real resource.
Well, we have, on the website, we have over 700 recipes, including cocktails and milkshakes. We also are putting up things about what's trending right now in food.
What do you think is trending in food?
Oh, I think poke is having its day in the sun.
Poke, really?
Poke.
I just read something about poke.
You're confusing it with Pokemon.
No, I'm
and
not.
And it's not the Hokey Pokey.
No.
It's actually the Hawaiian Poke.
It's not Pokey Go either. I don't understand that. Do you understand that?
Pokemon Go.
We don't.
You don't
We're
understand
not big
it
gamers,
either.
So yeah. Our kids do, but we don't generally.
Have you ever asked them to explain it? No.
I actually wouldn't. I would probably tune out after about 3 seconds of explanation, so I didn't want them to waste their breath.
I was hoping you might record it and send it on to me so I wouldn't look like such an idiot, because I can't imagine why anybody would be interested in this.
Oh, yeah. No, me neither.
So besides poke, I mean, I just covered the Fancy Food Show, and I'm from the Specialty Food Association, and I found that the overriding trends are health issues.
Right. Well, I think those are always there.
No, it's much more so than it ever was.
Okay. And anything with chickpeas, including brownies.
Oh, it's the year of the...
The year of the chickpea.
Of the pulse. The UN...
Oh, pulses in general, okay.
Year of the pulse, yeah. So, I just gave those brownies and blondies that with the chickpeas at base to a vegan gal at the gym, and she's raving about them.
Oh, that sounds great.
I wasn't finished with them, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you said you never wanted them again.
Golly. I don't understand it. The stuff arrives, I unpack it, I throw the boxes away, and then the food exits stage left before I even have a chance to try more than one.
I love your illustration for Rise and Shine, which is a new book out, by the way. We're going to be interviewing those authors in a couple weeks. Breakfast stuff, because breakfast is becoming a big trend. But mm-hmm. I love this illustration. Explain to me, you have 12 blank pieces of toast, and then
right.
11, and then the 12th one in the center of the bottom row has a fried egg on it.
It was just the notion of, you know, we called the brunch section Rise and Shine, and it's the idea of the eggs and the sun rising on toast. And
it was
really just to illustrate that idea.
Now, I wish you a lot of luck with this book. I mean, but apparently you're really popular. You have your own fan club everywhere, don't you?
We tend to have quite a few fans, so it's nice. It's great. We've got a great Bite Me community.
Oh, it's called a Bite Me community. That's cool, too.
Yeah, we've got our biters. Yep.
Now, your biters, as opposed to your little monsters. That's great.
Well, we are great. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we finally pulled this together. And did you have any other questions, Robert?
No. I'm trying to figure out if they're feeding that male tennis player, the one who did so well at Wimbledon, Tim Raonic. Is he a fan?
Oh, I certainly hope so.
He looks altogether
wellness,
too healthy.
Yeah, no, he's a fan for sure. Us Canadians, we stick together.
Well, thank you again, and as I said, much success with your book, and I'm sure you will have it since you are very popular, and also that your recipes are really delicious.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So there you have it, listeners, another entertaining program. We hope you enjoyed, and we hope that you'll enjoy following the instructions received from our guests this week, and that you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.